The White House has vowed to destroy ISIS. Defense Secretary Ash Carter echoed that vow and recently unveiled a new military strategy designed to do just that. Carter testified before the House Armed Services Committee and said U.S. forces will not let up until they've eliminated the terrorist army. Well, retired Lieutenant General Dave Barno is a distinguished practitioner in residence at American University. He assesses Carter's strategy.
I think it's an aspirational strategy. What I see in as I look back a year or so in terms of when the administration first realized it had a huge problem with ISIS, I see elements of the strategy they talked about last summer here, and we're simply adding new lines to what was already there in some respects. So in a lot of ways, I think what Secretary Carter articulated is really the administration still grasping for a strategy without really understanding the scope of this problem. The biggest difference is from a year or so ago is that ISIS now has become at least a regional, if not an international threat. And the strategy I hear talked about by Secretary Carter and others really still is probably too much focused on Iraq and on Syria. This is a much bigger problem now.
And in the intervening weeks, there seems to be reach of ISIS even into the United States, what we've seen in recent days.
Well, we're certainly worried about that over the 4th of July weekend here, and we see indications of ISIS radicalizing individuals out there, having various arrests being made around the country, and certainly a heightened state of alert with these threats. So this is not just something that's contained in the Middle East right now. It's ISIS has gotten powerful enough, and its ideology and its attractiveness is enough that it's reaching out and touching people all over the world and radicalizing them, and they're becoming a threat to their various home countries, to include the United States.
Because several military leaders have pointed out that their social media strategy, their Twitter and all of this, they're tweeting in something like 25 languages, is something that is very difficult to countermand, and we don't seem to be able to countermand it. And in any case, it's not probably the military is probably not the best place to countermand that aspect of ISIS.
No, it certainly isn't. In some ways, ISIS has tapped into one of our significant national vulnerabilities. You know, we talk about the interagency process where we bring in all the different parts of our government, the State Department, Treasury, Defense, Justice Department. That actually works in a way by exception. It's an ad hoc organization, and ISIS exploits all those seams between the various sectors of our government, which we typically don't get to work particularly well unless there's an intense crisis such as happened after 9/11. So I think we're vulnerable, and the social media is a perfect example of that. There just aren't, you know, parts of the government that are designed to be able to deal with that, and it's certainly, as you point out, not DOD's role.
Now, there have been daily bombing runs every single day at the DOD.mil, you know, news site. The same headline as appears, bombing continues against ISIS. And we're using planes that are about to be retired, like the 6A Prowler that's been in service for 40 years. What do you suppose military leaders actually think of what they're doing? We know what they have to say about the bombing, but what do you suppose they really feel about that level of effort?
Well, I've certainly seen some retired Air Force leaders suggest that this is a pinprick bombing campaign. It's not one designed to exploit the full capabilities of U.S. air power. And I think that's generally true. Part of that's rightfully constrained by the fact we don't want to inflict unnecessary civilian casualties. We're always extremely wary of that. But I think the upshot of all that is that we're using our air power so sparingly, it's not having any significant effects, that it's, at best, it's disrupting parts of ISIS. It's getting at some of their lines of communications. It's periodically disrupting some of their command and control, but it's not having an overwhelming impact on it. And I think that eventually is going to have to be relooked a bit, especially in Syria, where ISIS, in effect, has a large-scale safe haven, and in Raqqa, which is kind of their capital, if you will, of their organizational structure of the territory they own. That I think, could be pressured a lot more by airstrikes. But airstrikes alone are not going to solve this problem and are not going to, you know, defeat ISIS. There's no question about that.
And even if they are pinprick airstrikes, they still have the effect of wear and tear on military equipment, on the people operating the aircraft, and on the cost of replenishing the supplies used to do those pinprick bombings.
Well, they do, but they also point out that, as General Dempsey, the chairman of the JCS, pointed out in his new national military strategy here just this past week, that this is going to be a long-term campaign. This is a war without any end in sight. And so U.S. military has got to adjust to the reality that it's not going to be a campaign that gets done in 3 months and is over with, and we can then rebuild and repair our equipment. This is going to be a long-term, protracted campaign that's going to put that kind of drag on people and equipment, I think, as for as much as the next 10 years. And even Dempsey is coming out and saying that.
We're speaking with David Barno. He's Distinguished Practitioner in Residence at the School of International Service at American University and a retired Lieutenant General from the Army. And so let's talk about State Department for a minute. We talked about social media. We talked about the international radicalization. It seems perhaps that there should be more, and that's maybe one of the seams that you mentioned ISIS is exploiting. Should State Department have a bigger role here?
Well, State Department's got an extremely important role, and it's probably behind the scenes most of the time. Several of the things that State is doing and needs to continue to push very hard is to put pressure on the Iraqi government through our embassy and our diplomats in Baghdad to reach out to the full range of the Iraqi population, the Sunnis as well as the Shia and the Kurds. That, in many ways, is the source of the problems that we're seeing today in recruiting Sunnis into the security forces. The Iraqi government has marginalized them in the last 5 years. The other incredibly important task for the State Department is to maintain the political unity of this broad coalition of countries from around the region and from Europe that are keeping military pressure on ISIS, you know, to keep the Saudis involved, to do more with the Turks to help, you know, seal their border from the influx of foreign fighters. So State has a very, very significant, if behind-the-scenes, role here that it's playing, and it probably needs to continue to do more. To even hold this coalition together is going to be a major effort over the next several years.
And here at home, of course, the Homeland Security Department has a role, and it seems like they're being tactical also about it. Like there's not State Homeland Security, Defense, and White House National Security Council don't seem to be operating as a unit.
Well, I think each sees their particular part of the battlefield out there separately, and that's the nature of the divided government we have here. Department of Homeland Security is very much playing defense, as they have to. They've got to protect the nation from the potential for these threats coming home here to the United States. But they need to be aided by the Defense Department out there striking and disrupting, you know, the planning of ISIS in Syria and Iraq. And again, I think that's probably not as aggressive as it could be. In some ways, the challenge is who has the momentum, who has the initiative in this fight right now. And most observers would say ISIS does, that they're stepping ahead of the West and the United States and their social media. They're doing it on the battlefield. They're opening new fronts and new offensive operations in places that the U.S. and our allies and the Iraqis simply seem to react to, as opposed to being able to get in front of. We're not skating to the hockey puck. We're chasing the hockey puck down the rink in a lot of ways.
And without regard to the cost or the political practicalities and so forth, I mean, in a gaming world, what do you think a full military assault on ISIS would look like?
Well, part of the question is, are we politically ready to do that? I mean, most military observers would certainly say we're not going to defeat ISIS without boots on the ground. This is going to be a ground fight. You've got to have ground combat forces, infantry, armor, other forces that can actually take and hold territory. ISIS is very effective at that. They've got a very intimidating profile that in many cases we've seen small numbers of ISIS fighters actually drive larger numbers of Iraqi forces off the battlefield through intimidation as much as military force. So part of that strategy has got to include how you build a ground force to deal with ISIS to at least be able to hold territory to defend. And right now the Iraqi security forces are not doing that particularly well. But a broader strategy for the U.S. also includes probably a greater use of special operations forces. It might include having them out on the battlefield with air spotters that can actually deliver more effective airstrikes than what we're doing right now. We don't put any U.S. spotters out there on the battlefield to control these strikes, so that limits whether they're hitting the kind of targets they need to and having the effects they are, and we can't really assess that very well. So that's certainly part of it. I think greater role on the ground for special operations forces, maybe partnering with Iraqi special forces who are some of their better troops as well. So there's a number of different components to this. And then probably, as you noted earlier, a broader air campaign that strikes more targets, is more intense, doesn't have the, you know, the recovery time in between airstrikes that we see today.
And earlier you said this could be, and some of the military leaders now in power are saying that this could be a long-term type of drag and long-term effort, 10 years or longer. Anything in the National Defense Authorization Act activities for 2016, and they're coming close to a unified bill, anything in there that even addresses that whole issue?
Well, I think one of the things that's going to be a cornerstone in every defense appropriations bill or authorization bill here in the next several years is having the so-called overseas contingency operation money, you know, being put into these defense bills. President Obama, in fact, has threatened to veto this bill just because there's this large tranche of additional money that's not counted against the Budget Control Act caps from 2011. This money that is devoted to continuing these operations in Afghanistan, in Iraq, and Syria. So we're going to see this additional money, this supplemental funding, if you will, put on top of every defense budget in the coming years. And that's going to be essential to prosecute this campaign. Can't be paid for in the defense base budget. So I think that's where you're going to see a lot of the focus on how you actually prosecute a 10-year campaign or a 5-year campaign. It's going to be this Congress appropriating additional money every single year to do that.
And there's an incoming Joint Chiefs of Staff, a chairman, as soon as the Senate gets around to confirming him. There doesn't seem to be any opposition from the Marine Corps. What do you expect he's going to have to do first?
I think he's certainly going to have to be dealing with the crises of today, but as we wrote in an article in War on the Rocks, our defense blog, that Dr. Nora Bensel and I co-author every other Tuesday piece in, we wrote this past week that one of the most important things this next chairman, General Dunford, presumably is going to do is balance the demands of today, which are on the front page of the newspaper, with how you build a military for tomorrow, how you don't lose sight of the fact that warfare is changing. It's not going to look like counterinsurgency operations that the U.S. had 150,000 troops in Iraq and Afghanistan fighting for the last 10 or 15 years. How do you reshape this military with budgets going down, with new threats evolving, with a experience base that really is pointed towards yesterday? How do you shape it for tomorrow? So I think that's one of the most important things he's going to have to do. Within that, he's going to have to make sure he continues to recruit and keep in uniform the nation's best and brightest. That's what makes the U.S. military different. So those are all competing priorities for him as he looks at the next 4 years.